Whenever you start building the infrastructure, and the co-founder and I were both builders before we went into the Peace Corps. And so we started off building, you know, we saw that our neighbors didn't have a stove or didn't have a water tank or didn't have a retaining wall or a home. And so we built individual projects for them. And then we decided to scale it up, which is why we decided to build an entire school campus, right? And so if you really want to scale things up, what you can do, because there is some flexibility within the subject matter of the state mandated curriculum, you can take the lessons learned from the development of these projects and integrate it into the curriculum, right? And so in math class, basically, rather than doing some abstract type of math, you can conceptualize the math and go, okay, what is the math involved in this water tank? What's the math involved in this stove? And then, of course, the students love it. And then now our fifth, sixth, seventh grade students are all building stoves. The eighth graders are building water tanks. The ninth graders are building compost latrines and so on and so forth. So, you know, we've integrated it into the curriculum.
Welcome to the Social Impact Solutions podcast, where we help mission-driven leaders measure and market their social impact so they can raise more money and do more good. I'm Lauren.
And I'm John Mark. Together, we bring you expert insights, practical strategies, and real-world stories to help you create more meaningful and measurable change. This podcast is designed for purpose-driven leaders. So let's dive in, explore what's possible, and take your mission to the next level. Matt Benites, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. All right. So I've got a little bit of an overview of what you've done and what you've been building for the last 17, 19 years. I'm excited to get to learn more about that, but you get to share it with other folks. Why don't you just take a few minutes and talk about Long Way Home, why it matters, and then we're going to dive into the impact and what everything looks like moving forward.
Yeah, Long Way Home matters because we have done about 20 years worth of research, and we lived on the ground in a small rural town in Guatemala in the Western Highlands, about 7,000 feet in the midst of the Mayacachiquel people. And we used trash to build infrastructure for people living in extreme poverty. We integrated that into the curriculum, and we're about to share our lesson plans with the other public schools in town so we can fight poverty on a massive scale.
That's cool. That's really, really cool. Okay. So what I got to know beforehand is that you were in the Peace Corps. This is where you were located with the Peace Corps. It's been a wonderful time learning a lot, but doing a lot of research. Let's talk about the quality of research or the types of research you've been doing. What have you seen that was most effective, and how has that helped you build the model that you have today?
Yeah. So when you walk into a small rural town in Guatemala and you tell everybody that you would like to start using trash to build infrastructure, people are shocked. They're like, what in the world are you talking about? You know, none of us have ever heard anything like this. And then so what we did was we bought Earthship Volume 1, which tells you how to use a tire to build a structure. And so we put that tire on the ground, we packed full of dirt, and then we put another tire next to that. And then we had our first structure, which is a round structure. So we had officially built a small home for a local family using tires. We included locals, we included volunteers, and everybody loved it. It was really fun. Next to that, we built an earth bag house, right? So now we had tried earth bags and we tried tires. And then we spent 17, 18 years building the Hero School campus using a variety of alternative materials.
That's fantastic. And so you did mention individuals living in extreme poverty or families living in extreme poverty. Are we talking less than a dollar and a half a day level extreme poverty? Is that sort of the category in which we're regarding to?
Sure. We're talking extreme. We're talking about people that don't have water. A lot of them don't have electricity. They live in homes made out of corrugated metal. They spend all their days collecting, scavenging firewood and water rather than going to school and getting jobs.
Right. And so let's talk about what the alternative of these homes that you've been building. How much higher quality of life do we estimate, you know, for that kind of a change? Living from, you know, 10 roofs or 10 buildings that are thatched together. Spent plenty of my life in situations like that, so I totally understand. How much higher quality of life do they have with these building materials?
Well, so there was an earthquake in 1976 in Comalapa, and thousands of people died, right? So that's the number one priority, is to build homes where the roofs are not going to cave in on people. right? And built structures and classrooms. And so, and then on top of that, we're talking about having anything at all, right? So a lot of families cook over open flames indoors. That flame, the smoke fills the rooms and everybody's inhaling. It's the number one reason people go to the health clinic there. So in addition to building homes, we also build ventilated stoves. The families sit around the stoves. It uses less firewood, so it saves the family money. We build water tanks, compost latrines, retaining walls, classrooms, health clinics, you name it. And we're doing it out of trash because also there is no system of trash management in the area.
So you have an abundance of trash, have an abundance of people living in extreme poverty without access to any building materials or the financial situation to be able to buy or build a home of their own. Like, all right, how do we make 1 + 1 = 3 here? And that's what you were able to work on.
Yeah. And we've been doing it for, like I said, 20 years, and we've started to see some progress. We, you know, what you hope is that you set the example and that other people will pick up on it. And every once in a while, we'll stumble across a retaining wall or a family that built one of the examples that we set, and they did it on their own. We're starting to see that more and more.
That's fantastic. So I'd be interested to see things from like a cost perspective, how much money you're able to save people, how many lives are saved, because obviously you're on a fault line, you know, being right up there. So lots of earthquakes, lots of tectonic activity. You're at elevation, so there's even more challenges there. And so there's a lot of, you know, just infrastructure challenges that you're helping people overcome. But it's awesome to be able to see individuals that are replicating the model yourself. And like, where do you hope to see, or what do you hope to see with Long Way Home regarding scaling the infrastructure for other communities like this?
Yeah, well, so whenever you start building the infrastructure, and the co-founder and I were both builders before we went into the Peace Corps. And so we started off building, you know, we saw that our neighbors didn't have a stove or didn't have a water tank or didn't have a retaining wall or a home. And so we built individual projects for them. And then we decided to scale it up, which is why we decided to build an entire school campus, right? And so if you really want to scale things up, what you can do, because there is some flexibility within the subject matter of the state mandated curriculum, you can take the lessons learned from the development of these projects and integrate it into the curriculum, right? And so in math class, basically, rather than doing some abstract type of math, you can conceptualize the math and go, okay, what is the math involved in this water tank? What's the math involved in this stove? And then, of course, the students love it. And then now our 5th, 6th, 7th grade students are all building stoves. The 8th graders are building water tanks. The 9th graders are building compost latrines and so on and so forth. So, you know, we've integrated it into the curriculum.
That's so great. That is so great. And so have you looked at how much less expensive is it to build using these materials versus traditional building materials?
And the traditional building materials are generally cinder block, right? That's what most families are really trying to be able to build with. Sometimes it's corrugated metal, sometimes it's adobe, but the adobe isn't all that structurally safe in a place that has a whole bunch of earthquakes. And so what we've seen is that if you take your time and collect the materials little by little, that, you know, all of the walls of a house for the cost of paying a flatbed truck to drive along the Inter-American Highway and pick up 500 tires, the cost for that fuel is about $50 or $60. So all of the walls conceivably could be done for $50 or $60 compared to cinder blocks, which is going to cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars, if not thousands, right? And so if you collect the materials little by little, you can really, really keep the cost down.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And just thinking about, you know, being able to be in a structure. So again, talking about extreme poor communities, being able to be in a structure versus not being able to be in a structure, you know, just the net effect of that impact is really exciting to get to pursue.
Yeah. That's yeah. Great. And additionally, one of my favorite aspects is I did live in these structures. While we were building the school, basically the team and I, we would build a classroom and then live in it, and then build another one and then live in it, and then build a third one. And then by the time we had the 5th or 6th classrooms, 5 or 6 classrooms built, then we invited students to live in the first couple. But because we lived in them, we really got to see the nuance of the structure itself My favorite thing is it's cold in San Juan Comalapa because it's at 7,000 feet. We're not talking about the north part of the Guatemala. We're talking about the western highlands. And when you walk in those buildings, not hot, it's not cold. It maintains a consistent temperature, and we're not using anything to adjust the temperature on the inside. Thermal mass does the work.
That's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. And so what was it like living in a structure like that for so long?
Well, you know, in a place that there's probably, let's say, 5 to 7 earthquakes a month, or at least tremors, right? And then you go, okay, we built this. Now let's see if it works. And you know, rather than running outside, you ride it out, right? You sit there in the middle of the building because these tremors can be so strong, they can wake you up in the middle of the night. You wake up and then you can feel really the tires kind of like moving with the motion of the tremor rather than resisting it. It feels like they're working with it. And then over time, you know, a couple of hundred tremors later, you feel really confident about what the structures are capable of dealing with.
That's so great. And so where do you feel that these structures are most appropriate for, like similar communities at elevation, communities at any elevation? Like, what do you feel like is sort of a great niche for other organizations to adopt?
Well, if you take a look at Earthship Biotecture, they're doing this in Taos, New Mexico, right? So they're doing it also 7 or 8,000 feet, but they're doing it in the desert. And so the temperatures can get really, really hot and they can get really, really cold in Taos. So you pretty much can't think of a climate where it's not a reasonable thing to do. Of course, tires are wider than your average cinder block. So there's not a lot of people that are going to do it in cities, right? But as far as climate goes, it would be difficult to think of a place where you shouldn't use these alternative materials.
And there's not a lot of places where you can go where you can't find tires.
They're endless.
Any corner of the world, you're going to be able to find plenty of large tires. So what is your hope to see with Long? What do you hope to see with Long Way Home? Where do you hope to see the organization go? What is the ultimate goal?
Well, we'd like to clean up the trash, right? The trash is contaminating the air, the water, and the soil, and that is making people sick. And there is not an easy way to deal with this when the municipal government doesn't really have the budget to deal with the trash. Citywide. So we would like people to, you know, be less sick from less contamination. But we'd also like to see the people that are living in extreme poverty, that they have a better life. And we can scale this when we pass our lesson plans to the public schools, instead of it being like right now, we have 178 students and 25 teachers and a few green builders. And together, We are helping people that are living in extreme poverty. When we pass these lesson plans to the public schools, we can be hundreds, if not thousands of people. And because this is a problem all over Guatemala, there are endless communities facing the same thing. And then the same problems are in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Belize, and then throughout South America. So, you know, it's not only applicable in Comalapa or in Guatemala, it's applicable throughout the world, potentially. So less people suffering as quick as possible. That's our goal.
That's great. That's really, really great. So what do you see as your biggest barrier to getting more people living in these homes?
Money, right? All of this costs money. So we need more people involved. We need more exposure. So thank you for giving us the exposure because, you know, we're really good at building. We're good at building a curriculum. We're not great at publicity. So we really appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast and get some publicity. And that also leads to us, you know, receiving more donors, more volunteers, and that gives us a better chance to be more successful.
Okay. So tell me, what do your volunteers look like? What do you need to recruit volunteers for specifically?
Well, we're constantly doing green building projects. The campus is almost completely done, right? And so those volunteers are going to join our students and our teachers. They're going to go out into the community and they're going to do development projects. So like, for example, starting on October the 20th and going until November the 15th, we're going to go into a small village out in the middle of nowhere near Comalapa that's named Patsa. And we're going to build two classrooms for a community that needs a primary school, right? They don't have the money. So we're going to unite the people, unite the materials, bring our students, bring our teachers. And over the course of about a month, we're going to give them two brand new classrooms. And so volunteers are, you know, they're welcome to walk right into the middle of that. That's kind of our Indiana Jones version of what we do, is to leave Hero School and go out into these villages where people have the least amount of public services.
Mm-hmm. And it's very, very interesting. So let's think about this. Let's just sort of turn this on its head a little bit of thinking. You're solving an environmental issue, which is awesome. Love that. You're solving this a health issue. Let's just say that, like an individual health situation. But you're also solving like sort of a community involvement, social structure type issue. Is there anything I'm leaving out, you feel?
Well, there's a democracy element to this as well, because by working with people and them becoming familiar with the issues and then working it into a curriculum and then us working on things together and then us building a structure by which we do that, we're operating democratically, because what we need are everybody's ideas. We need the volunteers' ideas. We need the students. We need everybody to come together and talk about what's going on and then brainstorm how to do better, take notes, and then devise a system by which we might do that. It's a fairly democratic process. And what we've seen is people really do well within that space.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So what I'd love to see, I'd love to just explore, is what is, just from a base level standpoint, social return on investment. What is the SROI for somebody not having a home or having a, you know, tin roof to having a more secure home in a situation like Comalapa? What does that look like? Sort of like dollar per output, dollar per outcome, social return on investment. Then we can have the conversation around like moving into like the health side, because we've seen the data on what happens when you're cooking over an open stove, what that does from a health standpoint, what that does from like a child injury standpoint, the number of children that are, you receive unbelievable burns because it's really dangerous for families. I know you know this. There's a lot to unpack there. And so just thinking about those kinds of problems that you're solving, but also communities that don't get washed away every time there's a massive hurricane or earthquakes that go through. I spent, you know, a decent amount of my time in obviously Central America, but in the Caribbean as well, doing this kind of work. There's so many of these villages, you know, that every year get wiped out and just sort of strung back together. So having more strong structures like this, more secure structures like this, does make a big difference. And people are spending less time tending to their homes, spending more time either in school or working, and becoming much more, you know, economically productive individuals because of that. So I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Sure. One of my favorite examples was while we were building the school, a single mother with five children comes up to our campus and goes, "Hey, do you guys build any homes for families?" We were like, you know, we're really focused on the school because the school is going to be where we can scale our impact. And so we're not totally into that quite yet. We built a couple, right? And so we know why you're thinking that we might do this. And then a few of us got together later and we were like, you know what? Let's give this a shot. Let's build a house for this family. And so the single mother that we built this house for, she was living in a lean-to, right? And her kids were, you know, had all kinds of chronic illnesses that come along with not having enough water and the smoke and everything. We built them a home, and then all five of her kids have now graduated from high school. Before that, not a single person in her family had ever graduated from high school. And the reason that they were able to stop collecting materials to live and sort of scavenge on a regular basis was because the house provided them with everything that they need, that they needed, right? And so no longer were they out scavenging, and they found themselves with the time to pursue other activities that would improve their overall lives. Now, one of them is in law school. Another one's in architect school. Another one was like, "Hey, I want to keep being a farmer and doing sustainable agriculture." And so there has been this influence. Plus, they all graduated from our school as well.
Fantastic. What an amazing impact story. What an amazing story. I mean, you and I both know exactly what it looks like. Kids that are living in a lean-to, what exposure looks like, what their life looks like. And it is as hard as it gets. I mean, it's just sort of, if you want to pick one of the hardest existence, that's one of them. Hardest ways to exist. So what an amazing accomplishment there. I'm sort of going into consultant mode over here. And so just putting that hat on for a moment. What would it look like to create a partnership with a World Housing Project or a Habitat for Humanity type organization to where, you know, they do things that they get such great returns for economies of scale because they do massive projects. But you're flipping that model even further. You're taking that model even further by saying, no, actually, we use materials that are remarkably secure, but very, very accessible. You know, most of those organizations aren't able to target the extreme poor because these are loan-backed payments. I mean, typically they create no interest loans. So the individuals that aren't working are not able to do this. I mean, it's very much out of reach for them. Not always, but typically. That's a very interesting value proposition with what you've built, what you've spent almost two decades building, to go to a partner like that and say, hey, you be the strategic funder, we'll be the strategic partner, and we'll be able to do this for the extreme poor. Would that be interesting at all, or a conversation you'd be willing to have?
You know, we have it probably 6 to 7 times a week.
Yeah.
Because we have been partnering with Engineers Without Borders for the last 17 years. And because of that partnership, 8 complete villages now have water. We're talking about tens of thousands of people who were going to the river, collecting contaminated water, who now have water being piped into their homes. And amazing. So what the relationship looks like there is they go, the engineers are like, we'll design everything. We'll do the fundraising for it. What we need is access. Right? Because not everybody wants to move to Comalapa and live there for 17 years, develop the relationships, and then have access to the people that we have access to and the trust and the confidence that we've developed over time, right? Because it takes time for people to trust you, right? Enough to let you in to their spaces and offer and discuss these types of possibilities. Another relationship that we have is with an organization called WATA. It's water access to all people, right? And so they use us. They go, okay, we have 200 water filters that we would like to distribute. And we live in Los Angeles. We have regular full-time jobs. We do not have time to move to Comalapa. Do you have 200 people that need water filters? And then they fund the filters. They come to us for about a week. They work with our students to decide, our high school students, right? So this is constantly being integrated back into our curriculum. So there's another thing that is a major benefit is the students of our school are the ones who also know everybody the best. If you happen to say to one of our students, like, do you know anybody in a village on the outskirts of town or something like that that needs a compost latrine? Everybody knows somebody, so it stays kind of local. We also work with Terra Firma Floors. They're building 12 floors for families per month. They're two guys out of North Carolina who retired, who said, we want to build floors for families. And so we're saving them, goodness, how much money, right? In not having to set up an office and not having to travel all the time. We have transparent accounting. And so they work with us and they go, hey, we would, you know, like to build floors. And we go, we're exactly the people to do it. We include our masons, we include our students, we include the teachers, and then it is a full circle process. So I keep saying we're running a school, but you're like, what kind of school does this? Right? We're like more like a research institute as far as like, you know, but for primary, middle, and high school, right? So we're building relationships, we're developing curriculum, we're reimagining education to be more beneficial to the people.
Super practical, right? Super impactful, very much sink your teeth into it type of education. So when we say that the big constraint right now is money,
yeah,
you've got great partnerships.
We do.
Right? Pretty well-funded partnerships. could you float? And I know a lot of this is project-based, which can be challenging, right? It's like, okay, cool. Well, I guess we need another project. Do you need like a more developed fundraising motion, like a more developed, like, hey, we are now a fundraising organization? Because what you're doing right now is interesting because you've got such solid partnerships. Like, okay, how could we go deeper with Engineering Without Borders? How can we go deeper with XYZ Foundation who wants to fund these types of projects? I mean, there are plenty of nonprofits that are out there that are purely, you know, relationship-based in that regard. And they're able to scale to many millions of dollars a year because they have such strong relationships in the community. Like,
we didn't start our nonprofit the way some people do with, you have a whole community, you're from the North Shore of Boston, you have connections with a variety of businesses. I kind of jumped into it out of the middle of nowhere, right? And walked into, and then by the fact that I spent 17 years living on the ground and not taking the traditional executive director direction or position, which is, you know, live in the United States, make connections, fundraise, and then send the money. We were focused on making sure that we know what we're talking about, that we're making the right connections. And so, yeah, we're very interested in partnerships and relationships with people that can help us to fundraise, because while we do find it easier because of our partnerships to fundraise for some of the more concrete projects, what we find it most difficult to fundraise for is the teacher salaries, right? Because it's such an abstract, you know, we have 25 teachers and they're teaching students to eventually become the people that are going to really have a major impact. But it's kind of abstract, you know? Mm. And so that's really, we spend about $8,000 a month on teacher salaries, which is the core of the entire concept.
Yeah. And that's why it's so important. I love what you guys do. I think it's really cool. But just saying, that's why it's so important for people to be able to easily understand what does Long Way Home actually do? Like, what's the mission? What is it actually? It's an education organization that has a lot of interesting projects that are bolted on and create multifaceted impacts.
Sure.
And so like your education and infrastructure for the poorest communities in the world.
Yeah.
Which is awesome, right? I mean, my hat's off to you big time on that. Like, that's really, really cool. And so thinking about who are funders that care about that problem already, right? They're already pre-aligned, just to use that silly phrase, already aligned with a mission like that. They just had no idea you existed. That's what I like to think about when it's a situation, because when you're in the developing world, but when you're in really, really extreme poor situations, like you can't just do the one thing that most organizations are known for. Oh, well, we just do clean water. Listen, I know these situations. It's very near and dear to my heart. It's like, yeah, we had to do water. We had to do healthcare. We had to do nutrition. We had to do ag. We had to do homes because people are living in horrific situations. We can't just do one. The downside of that is no one understands what you do.
Well, you really nailed it with that. You know, we would love to only do ventilated stoves because it would be clear exactly what we're doing, how much each ventilated stove costs. However, the drawback to that is, where is it going to go in the future, right? But because we are doing this through school and building curriculum around it, we're truly working with the students and the teachers at the grassroots level who are going to be able to ensure that this continues beyond where Long Way Home started, right? This is how it has it. This is where its longevity comes from and its depth. Right? Because they're involved. They know what's going on. And we're not visiting over a weekend. They really understand and people are fully engaged. So
I think I'm totally with you. But I think you're, just from a strategy standpoint, from a fundraising strategy standpoint, I think you're a great candidate for grants, for family foundation, corporate foundation type grants, maybe even more than like individual donors for other reasons. But just thinking about, you build infrastructure. But infrastructure for the poorest communities in the world. Now, does that mean that the folks in Kamalapa are, you know, quote unquote, worse off than individuals in South Sudan right now? That's not the point. The point is these are individuals that are just extreme poverty and zero access. What I think would be fascinating in like a case for support, we do this, we do this, we do this, because when we do these three things, we get these massive outsized outcomes. Which you prove you have that. And the story about the single mom is just, it's that perfectly articulated of, this is what life like before. We did a home. I'm sure you did other projects as well. Now look at how the kids are doing, because you've got 18, 19 years worth of data to run with.
Yeah. And I guess like the thing is, we're not putting up huge numbers, right? Our graduating class from high school is 15 students, right? Where you might hear about another organization that did math on the radio and reached 300,000 people.
Exactly.
Right. So as far as like, you know, grants are highly competitive, and especially since there's, you know, less USAID money, there are more organizations that are reaching out to the same foundations, making the competition even that much more stiff.
Definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
And so, you know, instead of them getting 200 applications, they're probably getting 5,000. And every one of those applications is valuable, right? They're dealing with things that, you know, people need. And so that's what's been quite difficult. Now, you know, we win the occasional award. We were recognized by UNESCO in 2023 for our approach to education for sustainable development. And F5 is another amazing organization who recognized us last year with a grant that we'd never received from them before. And so, you know, we win the occasional award and get the occasional grant. I'm name dropping a little bit because these organizations mean a lot to us.
Yes.
The Henderson Foundation. There are a few organizations out there that really have carried us. And so there's, but there's a lot of competition.
There's a lot of competition, but I'm really glad that you said, you know, the math on the radio nonprofit versus what you're doing. Both are important, but we make a strong case for how do we go for depth of impact versus breadth of impact. You as an individual, like as your own bias from what I can tell, care a lot more about the depth. I mean, you spend 19 years there. And so like, it's how do we make the deepest impact that we possibly can? It's in a very concentrated group. So you're talking about $84,000 a year in teacher salaries. Like, okay, that's a solvable problem, right? When you can show me what the impact is as a funder, it's like, yeah, I'm interested. Like, show me the befores and afters. Show me the lean-tos. Show me your homes. Show me your, I mean, you have beautiful pictures on your website of the campus. Beautiful, beautiful pictures of that. And I just think it's amazing for people to see, how do you do more with less? And that's what you're doing. And you're saying you can replicate it. Again and again and again. We have this proof of concept in Taos. We've got this over here in Comalapa. We've got these opportunities over here. I think it's a fascinating conversation for saying, if you want to make a huge impact in infrastructure in the poorest communities in the world and education, here's the data to back it up. So again, case for support, theory of change, logic models, the whole deal. This is what we're doing. I think it's a very strong, compelling conversation for a grantor to say, you're telling me I could sponsor an entire village for 50 grand and have these outcomes?
Exactly.
It's like, well, how many villages can I sponsor then? You know what I mean?
It's endless, right? There are, you know, thousands and thousands of villages, like I said, with the exact same problems. And we are in a position to, you know, to tackle a whole lot of problems with the same dollar, right? So for $15,000, you build a classroom, but we're also going to be able to take all of the trash from that area and build the classroom. We're going to be able to decontaminate the air, water, and soil. We're going to train the people of that village on how to do this type of work. Then we're going to write lesson plans. Then we're going to share those lesson plans with the public schools. So for that, you know, same $1, you get 10 other things. It's kind of like buy one, get 9 things for free is our model.
100%. And more people need to know about it, right? Because there's this great quote from a Marine from World War II. He was in the Pacific and he said, we did more with less because we had less. I didn't have a choice. That's what we had to do. And so you're over here saying, yeah, we did a lot more. We're doing a lot more with less, but we're hitting the environmental side, the educational side. We're looking at an economic improvement because of those two things. We're looking at a democratic conversation. Now, a lot of Peace Corps backing in that, a lot of other interests in how do we advance democracies? How do we work more collaboratively with our partners? So much to say there. What I'd love to see, again, I'm putting the consultant hat back on, is a primary marketing channel to attract and convert ideal donors. not 20 of them, not 20 channels, one channel that consistently produces ideal donors. Because it's a fascinating story of how deep you can go. And we're talking about 15 grand for a classroom. It's going to take how many tires and how much trash out of the, you know, the non-existent landfills, right? Just the side of the road. How many students is that going to be able to take care of? And what are the educational outcomes going to be for that? And what can I expect from a social return on investment perspective as well?
And then there's another advantage that I haven't really mentioned yet is by involving volunteers, we're bringing people in from all over the world, really, like in all ages, right? Like even now there is a couple of families volunteering with us and they brought their kids. And because it's a safe, wonderful space to walk into, their kids at, let's say, 7th, 8th, 9th grade are going to have this experience that they're going to carry for the rest of their lives.
Mm.
They're not the only families that have come. We've had kids as young as 5, right, who can stomp around in the cob, right? So, you know, cob is dirt, water, and straw and a little bit of sand, and then you stomp around in it, and then you roll it around. And then you throw it on the walls, and then you can shape it into little birds or squirrels. And then those end up becoming the finishes for our buildings. So, you know, whenever those families come and they bring their young kids, but, you know, also, you know, we've had people that are 80 years old as well, who maybe can't stop around in the cob as much, but are like, hey, I've got some good ideas. I can teach you how to do this. So, you know, we're willing to share the experience of being able to live and work in Comalapa and experience the local culture and also need the help of the people who have all of this knowledge, who came before this, who are really good at something that we haven't had time to pick up and do.
That's great. That's great. So you almost have like a, you know, a missions application to this, sort of like, hey, come down from Boston, spend a week, a few days, however long, building the classroom, building these homes. Which again, just going back to, you know, a lot of these massive nonprofits that go into these building campaigns. So Habitat for Humanity and what's the parent organization? Fuller Center for Housing, I think is what they're called. You know, they'll go out and they'll build, you know, 500 homes in one community in 3 weeks. It's just this crazy commercial process. They get a lot of volunteers to do it. But a lot of those are paid volunteers. Like those volunteers pay to be a part of this. So that's definitely part of a fundraising strategy. If, okay, you're going to charge $500 for somebody to come down, you take care of them, but they also help build the homes or build the schools. I think it's an exciting conversation to have.
Yeah.
I'm excited for a few things specifically on just nailing the, getting the fundraising model, because you've been working for a long time on the impact model, which is extraordinarily important. But the second challenge for most nonprofits, for all nonprofits, you've got to figure out both models. What's the impact model? And then how are we going to pay for it? And I think right now it's like, how do you pay for the growth of this thing, which is an interesting place to be.
Yeah. And before COVID, we were doing really well with our earned income model, right? Because the earned income model is really the holy grail of the nonprofit world is, you know, you want to be able to complement your grants and your donations with the ability to earn some income, right? And so because we don't charge our students, by the way, you know, we work with low-income students. And for a lot of those low-income students, we charge them in trash to go to our school. So they'll bring a plastic bottle filled with candy wrappers that is packed really tight. And then we take that plastic bottle and we use it in the infrastructure that we're developing, right? And so for the students that can't afford to pay, you know, and we're charging $1 or $2 a month for most of the students, but some of them can't pay. I mean, everybody brings in some type of trash, but the ones that can't will bring in an extra bottle. But anyways, yeah, our earned income model was doing pretty well before COVID. And it's the most bizarre thing. So we were getting 10 or 11 service groups per year, which are basically universities that instead of going to Daytona Beach, right, and partying during their spring break, they would come and spend that time with us, going out into a village, working with us to build infrastructure for the school or for a family. And we charge such a reasonable rate to do that. It was kind of a win-win situation for everybody. And then on top of that, volunteers were spending $85 a week, right? And so the combination of the service groups and the volunteers was 60 to 70% of our income. And then COVID hit, and now we're getting very few service groups, we're getting very few volunteers. And it's like the opposite happened of what I thought. I thought that when COVID was over, that people were going to flood us. It was like, get me out of the house. I'm ready to travel. I'm ready to go have a good time. I'm ready to explore. And I can't tell you why, but yeah, for some reason, rather than getting, you know, 300 or 400 volunteers per year, it's more like 50 or 60. So I'm opening the door to let people know that there's space, the same opportunities exist. And in fact, because of COVID, we had time to improve our facilities, to improve what we were offering, to make sure that everybody could be as comfortable as they could be while they're with us. So that opportunity exists now.
I think that's really good. I know a lot of organizations like that were just smoked by COVID. You know, that's how they were making so much of their revenue. You know, the switch went off and it's like, ooh, we're going to have to figure out another way to fund this thing. That's a tough situation to be in.
Yeah, we got lucky. We did shift towards grant writing, and which, you know, the grant writing thing, and that shift was nice because when you start grant writing, you really stop. Because, you know, a grant application is are questions. And then your organization builds back up. You really have to take time to think and consider. Because it's like, you know, a grant application, what are your objectives? What are you doing? How are you doing it? Who are your partners? You really have to stop and think to answer those questions. And then it really has been a really good opportunity for us to build. And yeah, we have, you know, we're probably writing 60 to 70 proposals a year and getting maybe two or three of them.
Whoa. That's a lot lower than like averages. Right. I think 10 to 30% is sort of the typical close rate.
Right.
That'd be between 6 and 18.
It has not been easier this year with so much foreign aid, you know, being rerouted.
Yeah. That is tough, man. That is really, really low.
Yeah, I know. Well, we're going to keep trying. We're still writing all of these applications and still exploring. And as we write these applications, we get to know ourselves better and continue to improve.
And continue to improve. I think, Matt, this has been a really fun conversation. I've loved getting to learn about this. Is there anything you want to leave people with, though, as they listen to the conversation and what they can do or what you would like for them to think about moving forward?
I would like people to think about coming to visit us at Hero School and witnessing all of this in person and participating in person. And I want everybody to know that we need your help, not only financially, but your ideas, right? We're an incubator. We are a group of people that have opened the floodgates in this community for people with all kinds of ideas to come to us and go, hey, let me throw in on this. I have a great idea. And we want those ideas and can wrap them into our curriculum. We can wrap them into our green building. So we are totally open. Although it might sound like we have everything under control, we have a lot of room for improvement and a lot of room for growth. The other thing that I would really like to share is I'm so excited about is that we are close to sharing our lesson plans with the other public schools in town. Right. And so we are going to be able to scale this and we'll soon be hundreds, if not thousands of people fighting poverty together. Everybody is invited to participate in that. And it's going to be really fun and exciting. And we're going to see a lot of people who are suffering right now who will soon no longer be suffering.
That's fantastic.
I'm excited about that.
Man, my hat's off to you, man. Keep up the great work with this. It's been a fun conversation. And I appreciate what you do and all the time, energy, and effort you've put into it for almost two decades, man. That's fantastic.
Well, I get pretty excited about this. So sorry if I was yelling the entire time. You know, I'm like passionate about it. I care a lot.
I'm glad you do.
I sometimes raise my voice.
That is all of that is perfectly acceptable. Awesome, Matt. Well, thanks so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too. Take care.